So, tell me about last night.
Well, it wasn't what I expected. It had the perfect amount of spice.
Sounds hot.
It had all the flavor, and I wanted more. The ghost pepper wings from Popeyes are just so delicious.
Wait, I thought you were talking about your date.
Sometimes, things aren't always as they seem. Like Popeyes ghost pepper wings that have the perfect level of kick and flavor. Try them for only $5 today. Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants. Price may vary. Tax extra.
Love that chicken from Popeyes.
Hi, he's Robert Rodriguez.
And he's Richard Buskin.
Don't have to be that bitter about it.
I always wondered if the etymology of your name was like the guys that are like the panhandlers in the tube, you know, for money. They're Buskin. Well, is that where it came from? Seriously.
Refuse to answer that.
I can totally see that.
Actually,
happening.
If you listen, John Lennon in 1970, his Jan Wenner interview.
Yes.
There's a point there where he goes, I could have been Buskin.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
That should be on your website.
Absolutely.
That should be your ringtone.
There you go.
John Lennon.
Anyway, let's get on with the show here.
Have you ever said I could have been Lennon?
Many times.
Hilarity ensued. Okay. Get on with the show. Right. Well, we promised you last time we were going to talk a little bit, being the 50-year anniversary of things. The very first Beatles Christmas message was recorded in October 1963, their first really big year. And let's talk about that a little bit, and then we'll play some.
It's kind of weird if you think about it. You're standing in a studio in October and having to sort of raise the festive spirit, you know, and playing Jingle Bells. And
right.
Yeah. But I think, you know, those Christmas records, we're talking about the 63 one, but actually if you listen all the way through 63 through 69, it's almost the Beatles story encompassed.
Oh, isn't it though?
You know, they start off really kind of straight, those messages, don't they? And just like innocent fun, 1963.
Right.
And then they get a little bit more out there and a little bit more out there. And
yes.
By the mid-60s, we've got psychedelia thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end, they're not
very
even
produced.
Recording. Yeah, and they're not recording together by the end. It's
right.
Kind
and
of the whole story is in there.
It's like their last promo film, the Something film that was sliced and edited together as a whole and are not even in the same shot.
Right.
You know, it was all separate occasion. But yeah, it's very interesting, as you point out. It was the brainchild of Tony Barrow, their publicist, that wanted to give the fan club members something a little special at Christmas time. And it was a really good idea. You know, these little flexi discs that, you know, I didn't know this till I started doing the research, but the American fan club members were served really indifferently when it came to the messages, in terms of we didn't get them new every year like the Brits did. And we were actually like a couple years behind. I think there was a couple that we didn't even get.
What?
Yeah.
So like, in 65, they're wishing you Merry Christmas for 1963.
I'd have to look at it or, you know, check, you know, anybody listening, you know, just check out Speiser's books or whoever is out there that's written about it. But yeah, we didn't get the same number and we didn't get them necessarily when they were new up until I think 67 or so. And then at that point on, they were in sync, but it was very strange that way.
So basically, you're saying that the Beatles split up in 1971 here.
Well, and until the Beatles Christmas album came out, yeah. The Americans hadn't even heard every single message, which
so
is
weird.
Yeah, it is. But it's the stuff is brilliant, and why Apple refuses to get serious and put them out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if they're still waiting for the original generation to die off first or what. But you know, it's leaving money on the table. They should put the stuff out. Yes, it's been bootlegged to death, but a really nice definitive package would be great.
But isn't that always the pattern with Apple? You know, wait for it to be bootlegged to death.
Yes.
You know, then bitch about the fact that you've lost all this money because it's been bootlegged to death.
Yeah.
And then finally put it out.
Right, because everybody who had an interest already owns it times 10 anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that's what happened with Hollywood Bowl back in the 70s.
Right.
You know, and in England, you know, where they released Magical Mystery Tour as an EP.
Mm.
And in the States, it was an LP for years with those extra tracks.
Right.
And then they finally had to cash in Britain years later.
Right.
You know?
It was like the one capital package that made sense of the 60s, where they collated all these loose 67 singles. Now, my understanding was in Britain that it was available as an import. Was that your experience when you were?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and did you pick it up at some point?
Yes.
Had the American?
Yeah. It was actually quite easy to get as an import.
That's cool.
But EMI wasn't making the money off it.
Right. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Anyway, back to, we digress here, back to the Christmas record from 63.
Right.
What's your favorite part of that? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Ringo.
Ringo, yes.
Yeah,
and they start, and every time he picked it. All right, let's hear it.
Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the feast of Stephen, as the slow ray round about, deep and crispy, brightly showed the boot last night on the musty cruel. Henry Hall and David Lloyd, Betty Grable too.
Hello, this is John speaking with his voice. We're all very happy to be able to talk to you like this on this little bit of plastic. This record reaches you at the end of a really gear year for us, and it's all due to you. When we made our first record on Parlophone towards the end of 1962, we hoped everybody would like what we'd already been our type of music for several years already. But we had no idea of all the gear things in store for us. It all happened, really, when Please Please Me became a number one hit, and after that, well, Court of Blimey's Heather No. Our biggest thrill of the year, well, I suppose it must have been topping the bill at the London Palladium, and then, only a couple of days later, being invited to take part in the Royal Variety Show. This time last year, we were all dead chuffed because Love Me Do got into the top 20, and we can't believe, really, that so many things have happened in between already. Just before I pass you over to Paul, I'd like to say thank you to all the Beatle people who have written to me during the year, and everyone who sent me gifts and cards for my birthday, which I'm trying to forget, in October. I'd love to reply personally to everyone, but I just haven't enough pens. In the meantime, Gary Crimble to you, Gary Mimble to you, Geddy Babel, dear Christmas, happy birthday, me too.
This is Paul here. Everything that John said goes for me too, especially the bit about birthday cards and the parcels, because all our homes and offices got stacks of mail last June.
Ow!
Well, it was my birthday. Anyway, we're all dead pleased by the way you've treated us in 1963. And we'll try to do everything we can to please you with the type of songs we write and record next year. Oh, yeah, somebody asked us if we still like Jelly Babies. Well, we used to like them. In fact, we loved them. And we said so in one of the papers, you see. Ever since then, we've been getting them in boxes, packets and crates. Anyway, we've gone right off Jelly Babies, you see. But we still like Peppermint Creams and Chocolate Drops and Dolly Mitchells and all those sort of things, don't we?
Yes, yes, oh yes.
Well, lots of people asked us what we enjoy best, you see. Concert and television or recording. We like doing stage shows because, it's, you know, it's great to hear an audience enjoying themselves. But the thing we like best, I think so anyway, is going into the recording studio.
Yeah, lovely. We enjoy that.
Love
very
that,
kindly.
To make new records, which is what we've been doing all day before we started on this special message. Well, what we like to hear most is one of our songs, you know, taking shape in a recording studio, one of the ones what John and I have written. And then listening to the tapes afterwards to hear how it all worked out, you see. Well, I'm running out of my time and people are telling me to stop. Like,
stop,
Ringo,
stop,
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 stop
shouting
so,
those animals.
I'll finish now with it. Wishing everyone happy Crimble and a merry new year, and especially all the ones who paid the subscription.
Ja, das wird und Dankeschön und den Christbund even. Ja, den Christbund even. Yeah, that's weird. Wunderschön, boy.
Dankeschön. Ja, Ringo.
Hello, Ringo here. As you know, I was the last member to join the Beatles. I started to play drums in the group 1962. I've been a couple of other groups.
Oh, just wish the people merry, happy. Go on for Christmas.
Merry, happy New Year. And folks, happy Christmas and May everything you wish be granted.
Singers Wenceslas, King Wenceslas.
King Wenceslas.
Well, good King Wenceslas last looked down on the feast of Stephen, when the snow was on the ground, deep and crisp and even.
Thank you, Ringo. Thank you, Ringo. We'll phone you. I'm George Harrison. Nobody else has said anything yet about our fan club secretaries, Anne Collingham and Bettina Rose. Not to mention Frida Kelly in Liverpool.
Get out, Frida!
So on behalf of us all, I'd just like to say a great big thank you to Anne, Bettina and Frieda for all the hard work they've done. And we just hope you can go on pleasing you for
Keep
a long
screaming.
Time. Because it's your reaction to our records that really matters. And I'd just like to say, brightly was the shone that night, though the winter cruel, when a pork pie came inside, gathering winter cruel.
No grain day had a very shiny nose when everybody told him.
Mickey the red nosed negro
had a very shiny nose.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Well, that was Beatles humour in 63, and I mean, the person who was always known as the main joker of the group, let's say, the Edge. It was always John, wasn't it? John speaking with his voice.
It's amazing how funny all those guys were. I mean, here we are. You know, there's a million different reasons that we're still talking about the Beatles 50 years later, and it will continue to forever and ever. But it's like, I don't even know, were any of their peers making Christmas messages, and has anybody heard them? You know, what else? I mean, we're so incredibly lucky that, you know, not only we have these fantastic records and we have the films, but this sort of ancillary stuff that they just tossed out there that is such a brilliant encapsulation of the times.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that, as you say, it's we've got so much on them. We've got their humor as well as their music,
right,
as well as their writings, as well as their acting, as well as their TV show. You know,
right,
it just goes on and on and on.
And they're just adept at everything they touch.
Which is why we've got this show.
This is why we got this show.
There's so much to talk about.
Right. Too much about the Beatles.
Yes.
All right. We were talking about Edgy John.
Yes. So it's his birthday, October 9th.
That's right. 9th of October, which he's trying to forget.
Yeah, and I thought, let's take this a sort of slightly perverse route. Let's do something a bit different here. Instead of talking about our favorite John songs,
yes,
how about our least favorite John songs? I mean, ooh, you know, I just want everyone to know out there, love John. So, uh-huh, you know, don't think this is a put down to John Lennon on his birthday. But
keeping it real, folks.
Yeah, exactly. But let's just do something a bit different here. What's your least favorite? But ones that just come to mind, solo or Beatles.
Where do I start? No, not at all. Just kidding, folks. Don't write me letters. You know, to be honest, and it's sort of like, you know, when you've got the Beatles and everything about them that is so steeped in your DNA, it's almost like a familial relationship, mm-hmm, where it's like, you know, you can criticize them, but don't let somebody else criticize them.
As John said about the Beatles.
Yeah, and yeah, it's true enough. So, you know, I would be dishonest if I would say, oh, I love everything they did was great. And that's stupid.
Right.
You know, it's pointless. And it's
just, and you're not a stupid guy. So.
Well, says you, until I prove otherwise. I would just say that if you're at all honest and if your opinion is to have any credibility at all, mm-hmm, then you could say, hey, you know what? I think they missed the mark here.
Right.
And, you know, just right off the top of my head, a song that I thought was, you know, possibly a little under effort on his part, When I Get Home from the Hard Day's Night album.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to love you till the cows come home.
Yeah.
Like reaching out to the dairy farmer demographic or something. What is that? It just sounded kind of lazy and tired to me.
Wow. That's interesting. Well, one of
mine. Maybe it's an American thing. I don't know.
One of mine that I'll always skip past is, you know, if I'm like listening in the car, will be Dig a Pony.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I as a composition and even as a performance, it's, to me, it was always kind of substandard, John.
Well, I could see as a composition, maybe, because it's so just, it's the free association lyrics thrown out there, that if you watch the Let It Be film where they're on the roof and he's got that guy kneeling in front of him with the clipboard.
Yeah, the red haired guy.
Right, because he can't remember his own stuff. I thought the singing was great. And I love George's guitar fills and Ringo's tom-tom work.
And even the harmonies, you know, between John and Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, but I don't think they're that tight. And of course, it was that whole Let It Be thing of not correcting.
Right, well,
you know,
ragged but right.
Yeah, but I don't know. Never
it's kind
one
of bandish to me.
Right.
The band. And so I get that, but I can't hate on it. But I see you're seeing it as sort of substandard Lennon. I get that.
Mm, so. Yeah. And then what about Solo?
Solo?
Yeah, Solo. Let's beat up on him.
Okay.
So. Let me think. What one? I mean, something like Meat City or Tidal.
Oh, no. You just named like the two favorite songs on Mind Games.
those of you out there in listener land, you should have seen my partner. His eyes swelled. He almost got out of his seat.
It's to throttle you.
It's funny, though, that you gravitate toward the Mind Games album, because I would say if I had to pick any substandard Lennon solo material, it would probably be on that album.
Or also actually Double Fantasy.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
I must say, I never liked Dear Yoko. I think that that's a kind of, you know, rehash of Oh Yoko and not a very good one.
Not a very good one with the sort of Buddy Holly ambience thrown into it.
Right.
I never liked Cleanup Time.
Right.
Yeah. That sounds so forced to me.
Yeah. That's, some of the numbers on Double Fantasy, to be honest, do for me as well.
Yeah. And it's going to be really hard, I think, for most people to separate what happened after it came out from the actual content of the record, you know, because they were so close together, like I think 3 weeks separating them or something. But, you know, the initial reviews coming out in England were not all that positive, which you could probably attest to.
Mm. Well, okay, now let's stop beating up on him, you know,
okay,
before everyone turns off here. So one of my favorite Lennon tracks, I think, like lyrically, I know it's one of his favorites, is Across the Universe. Maybe not the best recording of one of his numbers, but I think it's just a wonderful piece of poetry.
It is. It's so unique within his body of work. I mean, he did nothing else that sounded like that at all. Mm. You know, just the whole meter to it, the flow of the words. It's a very singular piece of work. Do you have a favorite take of the versions that have been released?
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. My favorite actually is on the Let It Be Naked. I think that they actually did as good a job as they could do with that track. They add reverb at the end, you know, and kind of fatten the sound of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is my personal favorite.
I like that one a lot. That one very much stands out. I didn't care. You know, I like the Wildlife one okay with the flapping wings and stuff like that, but I don't like the sped up, you know, raising his voice up.
Right.
It kind of undermines it. And I never had a problem with the Let It Be one. I know some people do. Oh, Spectre ruined it. You know, bullshit. Yeah. Can I say that on the podcast? I like the orchestration. I think it's, you know, some reviewer called it majestic, and it serves it well.
Yeah.
But the one with the backing vocals by the two amateurs,
yes,
Lizzie Bravo and Gaylene Peace.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of great.
Yeah, it is. Let's actually listen to two of them. Let's listen to the original one that was on the Wildlife album, and then we'll segue into the mix that was done for Let It Be Naked.
Right.
Rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me. Before me like a million eyes, they call me on and on across the universe. Thoughts meander like a restless wind inside a letterbox. They tumble blindly as they make their way across the universe.
Change my world. Nothing's gonna change.
exciting and inviting me. Limitless undying love which shines around me like a million suns and calls me on and on across the universe.
During the break, our producer Tom decided to dive into the fray by saying he doesn't like Wars and Bridges, which, you know, I know some people do find it a kind of weak album. I completely disagree. I think it's a fantastic piece of work, and it's a very cohesive piece of work as well, because there's a theme, isn't there? He's missing Yoko. Apart from Surprise, Surprise, Sweet Bird of Paradox, which is about May Pang, his mistress at the time, the rest of the album is all about the lost weekend and missing Yoko.
Yeah, it's almost like, and I talked about this in the Fab Four Fact 2.0 book, that it's almost like a thematic sort of latter-day Frank Sinatra in the wee wee hours, sings for only the lonely. It's like this thematic coming-of-age collection where he talks about sort of creeping up on adulthood and still trying to live like an adolescent and how it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And whatever coping mechanisms you can find to, you know, make it work for yourself. Yeah, there's the elements of missing Yoko, but it's not overt throughout the album so much as, you know, there's just, you know, his sort of adulthood crisis as he talks about in Scared very explicitly.
Yes.
You know, that's a song that easily could have been on the Plastic Ono Band album. You know, take away the horns and the Jesse Ed Davis, you know, crying guitar. That's our producer.
Yeah.
Putting a noose around his neck.
Yes.
let's listen to it. And, you know, you be the judge, listeners.
And the price that I pay, and the straw slip away.
That was Scared. And you notice that wolf cry at the beginning of the track. My son's got some game, some app, something on his iPod where it seems to sample the same exact wolf cry. And when I put that track on, the Lennon track, in front of him, he's like, he got that from my game.
Yeah,
like,
right.
No, that was actually recorded about 35 years ago. So, but
the thing about that whole album, again, the Walls and Bridges album and a track like Scared, is I think, you see, unlike Double Fantasy or some of the tracks on Double Fantasy, I don't think it is contrived. I don't think it is forced. It's the real thing. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, if you read the story of him, you know, going through that so-called lost weekend, and, you know, in retrospect, when he was doing the Double Fantasy interviews, he's so incredibly dismissive of that work. It's like anything that had nothing to do with Yoko, you know, her direct hands-on involvement, he was very dismissive of.
A semi-sick craftsman.
Yeah, and it's such crap. I would say that about Mind Games when they were breaking up, and the production and the mixing of that album sounded so rushed. You know, even good songs suffered. And not until, I think it was 2006, when they started putting out the remixes of his back catalog, and you could actually hear what was on the Mind Games album. It's like, wow, you know, this really is better than we knew in 1973.
Right.
But Walls and Bridges, I think by that time he'd produced the Nilsson album. You know, he was he had done a work with a bunch of people that year. Chronologically, I'm not sure if I don't think Goodnight Vienna had been worked on yet, but in any event, he'd worked with Mick Jagger, the Too Many Cooks track. He was getting experience as a producer and really getting his craftsmanship together. And I think that he achieved what he set out to do with the Walls and Bridges album as a sonic piece of work, that not only does it sound good and accessible, you know, this veneer of sugarcoating to these very deeply personal songs that were much more listenable than anything on Plastic Ono Band without sacrificing the art. But, you know, he got a number one album out of it.
Absolutely. I interviewed Roy Sicala, who's one of the engineers on that album. I've also interviewed Shelly Yakas. But I remember Roy Sicala just saying about how professional John always was in the studio. You know, he prepared all the musicians, and he was really easy to get along with, and he worked fast, as we know. You know, he didn't like to toil over things.
Right, the labor
things. But he created a really good atmosphere in the studio, and he said he was a total pro.
Yes, yeah. Very disciplined, focused, and, you know, if you listen, you take John's word for it, oh, I was just missing Yoko in such desperate straits and bottoming out. You know, it's belied by the work that came out that year.
Right.
That he did. You know, everyone's lost weekends should be so productive.
Yes.
You know, two number one hits for other artists that he collaborated with, you know, Fame with Bowie and the remake of Lucy in the Sky with Elton John.
Yes.
Both went to number one. Bowie's was his first number one. And, you know, he crafted a number one album with a number one single. Never happened again in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, worked with Ringo, worked with Mick, you know, produced Pussycats, which is this great sort of missing link album between rock and roll and Walls and Bridges. You know, semi-oldies and semi-deep. Deeply personal songs.
Yes.
You know, he just really had gotten his art together that year, despite, you know, the Troubadour and the Kotex stuff you read about. You know, it wasn't 18 months of that stuff, folks.
Right. Just before we finish with John Lennon, we're going to listen to one more track, which is a fairly sort of unusual track on Walls and Bridges because it's got a whole different sort of production sound, which is Number 9 Dream. And one little story I'll tell you about that Roy Sicala told me was that at the end of the song, you've got that refrain, Arbawakawa Puse Puse. And, you know, John sort of said that came to him in a dream when I just sort of dreamt that sort of nonsense phrase. But it was originally going to be Arbawakawa Pussy Pussy. Until the Apple, is he Al Corey? Was he the?
Yeah, yeah.
He was the press guy.
Capital.
Yeah, the Capital, that's right. Uh-huh. And he basically said, there's no way. We can't put the record out with Pussy Pussy on there. And so Roy's wife, Laurie, who was one of the backing singers on there, she basically said, well, look, let's just try and make it kind of French sounding. Pousse, pousse.
Right.
And so that's what ended up on the record. And Roy said that he was quite happy to go along with that. You know?
It has the same meter. It flows. It works with the music.
Yeah.
And it's just exotic enough that people can't accuse him of flat out being salacious.
Absolutely.
It seemed to be the theme that was on the brain that year, because I don't know if you knew this, but the original title of Pussycats, the Nilsson album,
yeah.
Do you know what the original title was?
No.
Did RCA balk that? Strange Pussy.
Whoa. And in fact, if you still look at it, Pussycats is not one word. It's actually Pussy Cats.
Yes.
So they're referring to themselves.
Oh,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
As you do.
Yeah.
So that
was the obsession of the year, I think.
Right.
You know, it really was. But anyway, let's take a listen to Number 9 Dream.
Number 9 Dream, the second single pulled from the Walls and Bridges album, which, as it happened, peaked at number 9 in the Billboard charts in America, early 1975. Yeah, it was a number. I was going to point out, too, when we were talking about the production of that, you know, he'd worked on the Pussycats album earlier that year, and the lead track on the Pussycats album was Harry's cover of Jimmy Cliff's Many Rivers to Cross.
Yeah.
And if you listen to that, and most people, because that was not a number 1 selling album, didn't get to hear that album, which was their loss, but it is out there on CD. The arrangement John did, it sounds like a slowed down version of Number 9 Dream.
Absolutely.
That string section.
That is what he borrowed it from.
Yeah, he repurposed
Number 9
it.
Dream.
Totally.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
We've spent a lot of time on Walls and Bridges and Harry, and we'll probably cover it in a later show in more depth, but clearly it's something near and dear to Richard and I's hearts. And
being it's our show, we'll talk about it.
We'll talk about whatever the hell we want to. But right now, we're going to turn the floor over to somebody that is getting a lot of attention these days, rightly so, for the great work he does. And I'm speaking of the preeminent Beatles historian of the day, your friend and mine, Mark Lewison.
Yeah, and in this second part of this interview that I did with him, he talks about his fantastic new book, The Bible of the Beatles Literary Canon, All These Years. Yes. Yep, All These Years, Volume 1, Tune In. And I talked to him about, you know, the researching and the writing of this incredibly lengthy book. So, Mark, what were your initial goals when you started this project, and how did those evolve over time?
My initial goal when writing this book was to try to write the Beatles history as I had always wanted to read it. I always felt that the books that were published, the biographies in particular, that were published about the Beatles were perhaps okay in themselves, but not good enough to do the subject justice, because the Beatles subject is such a huge one. And, for example, neither Hunter Davis's book from 1968, the original authorised biography, or the kind of acknowledged best next biography, which was Shout by Philip Norman, both of which came out a very long time ago, neither of them really get into the music, for example. And I felt that the music is obviously, you know, paramount to everything that the Beatles achieved. So that needed looking at. But I also felt on a more general level that as a history, this needed telling in a more comprehensive fashion, and that the story could take it, you know. Writing it in one volume would mean missing out too much. Writing it in three volumes would mean doing it justice. But the key point is the subject is deep enough and rich enough to sustain three books. So I felt that that was what I wanted to do. And I had no idea it would take quite as long as it has. But all the same, now that the first volume is out, I am very, very happy with it. And I'm moving on now to volume two, which will keep me busy for a few years as well. As to how the project evolved, I think that really it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. Every time I tried to anticipate how long this thing might take to write or how many words it might be, it just grew. And it ended up taking twice as long as I thought, and basically being about three times the length that I considered it would be, which presented a lot of problems in itself. But the whole premise was, don't cut any corners, let's do this properly. It'll never be done so thoroughly again. It's never been done this thoroughly before. So on that basis, just write what the story needs in order to be, as I would consider it, properly understood. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I spoke to more and more people. And one person led not just to one more, but to five more. And when I came to write it, I realized where I was light, and then went off and did even more research. And so it just, you know, when you're attempting to tell something very, very thoroughly, it is incredibly hard to predict what your journey will be as the writer. And I certainly had that experience.
Yeah, you actually touched on something there that I was going to mention, where one interviewee would put you in touch with another interviewee. What were the biggest challenges in terms of the research?
Oh, well, every aspect of this project was a challenge, and because it was an attempt to write the story so comprehensively and so accurately, I mean, that by definition you've got challenges right there, and they weren't so much a surprise to me as just something that I had to hurdle. Basically, to continue the athletic theme, I set the bar really high on this book for myself. You know, if this book was going to be what I believed it could and should be, then I knew I had to work very, very hard and try really, you know, to do the best book ever. And so I set the bar high, but I reckon that I jumped it pretty much. I certainly always felt if I hadn't quite done enough, I would go back and do that little bit more to make sure that I had. In terms of interviews, the first challenge was to find people who haven't been interviewed before, because I find that if you look at most of the Beatles books on the shelf. They tend to rely on the same talking heads every time. And that means that essentially you're going to get the same story as you've read in other books, and that all the books are going to have pretty much the same thing. After all, if you interview someone for the, if someone is interviewed for the 500th time, what are they going to tell you that they didn't tell in the previous 499? The only way that what they can tell you is different would be if they make something up. And I certainly don't want anyone to make anything up for me. So my challenge was to find new people. And actually, it wasn't that hard a challenge at all. Finding, actually locating them wasn't always easy, but actually knowing who I wanted to speak to was relatively straightforward. Once you start digging deep, you begin to find names of people who you think, oh, I'd like to find that person. And finding them can be tricky, but when you get to them, provided that you win their confidence, that you assure them of your scruples and morals, that you're going to treat their story respectfully and that you're going to do right by them, then people will open up. But the other thing I did that I'm really happy to have done on this project, and I'll continue this for the second and third books, is that when I went to interview someone, I would always take with me things that would help unlock their memories. Because if you simply ask a question, you're not necessarily going to get beyond the top level of their memory. And you might get an answer, but it won't be the richest answer. It won't be one with colour and context that actually is going to make this quote rise off the page. So I take with me, whenever I'm seeing someone, things that will unlock the memories for them. I take photographs, I take recordings, I take film or video, I take contracts and letters, all sorts of documents. I take anything at all, posters, badges, scarves, something relevant to the period. And it's amazing how much that works. I understand that in psychotherapy terms it's called early memory. So that you can actually tap into someone's memory and make them remember something that they haven't thought about for a very long time. And it worked every time. And the quality of the interviews went up exponentially as a result of that process.
In terms of the subject matter, you obviously learnt many things during the course of this project. But what are the main ones that come to mind?
It's very hard because very hard to answer that question, because the book is actually a combination of two things. Well, it's a combination of many things, actually, but two I'd like to mention in particular. One is there's a lot of all new stuff in here. Now, people say, oh, God, the Beatles, you know, they've been around 50 years. We've got all these books. Everyone knows everything about them. What more could we possibly know? So that's the first challenge, and I think I've hurdled that one really easily because there's so much in this book that's new. The second thing is that it refreshes elements of the story that are known. It pumps life, if you like, back into things that you do know and puts them in their proper context so that even they seem fresh. So you're reading things you know, but you're reading them in a way you haven't read them before and in a manner that you haven't read them before. So when you actually slide those two things together, new and refreshed old, then you have a pretty dynamic package. And what it all adds up to is a level of detail and a level of intimacy with this subject, in the sense that you feel as the reader, well, people tell me this, that people who have read it, they feel that they're right there with them when this is happening. They're in Liverpool, they're in Hamburg, they're in their houses, they're in the van going to gigs, they're in the recording studio with them, because it has an immediacy to it. So there are, well, probably thousands of things in this book that people won't know. But the combination of the entire package is going to be like a complete refreshing of the story. And it's needed because it's not been told very well, and it's not been told very well for a very long time. And all I've done is tell it in the way that I believe it should have been told from the beginning, but nobody else ever did.
Okay, final question. 1963 alone will probably take up a lot of space in the next volume, with the events flying at you thicker and faster than ever before. Clearly that was the trend as the first volume progressed. So have you figured out yet how you're going to cope with that? Not least because 1964 will then take things to another level.
Well, the thing about the Beatles story is it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and faster and faster and faster and more encompassing, in the sense of it starts off as a Liverpool story, then it becomes Liverpool and Hamburg. By the end of Volume 1, it's becoming the rest of England. By the end of and then as I get into Volume 2, it just has to eventually envelop pretty much most of the world, or certainly the world that listened to Western music. So that's my challenge. It's going to have to be to accommodate all the things that are going on in all the countries that got into the Beatles. And of course, that's going to be tough. It's not impossible, but it will be tough. I actually liken towards the end of the first book, I likened it as a writer to spinning plates. You know, if you go to the circus, there'll be a clown or an act who's spinning plates, and eventually some of those plates on top of those sticks will start to wobble, almost fall off, and the guy will have to run back and give them another spin. That's rather like it is at the end of Volume 1. There's so many things going on simultaneously in different places that by the time I've left one element of the story and gone off and told a few others, it's 50 pages since I was last spinning that particular plate, so I have to go back and give that another spin because it's still part of the story. Well, that's going to get exponentially a lot more complicated, I would say, in Volume 2, because, for example, I'm going to have to leave the UK, which is really where the Beatles story always is central. I'm going to have to leave the UK for chapters at a time to talk about the Beatles' impact in America and in other countries. So it's going to be tough, but it's such an exciting story, and it's such an encompassing story that it's doable. If I didn't feel it was doable, I wouldn't be trying to do it. But it is doable, but it's going to be tough. But I've got to keep the reader engaged the whole time. The best thing is that I'm not writing about a subject that no one's interested in. You know, I know I'm writing about a subject that completely absorbs people, and for all the best and right reasons, because it is something that was then and still remains very, very special. And all I've got to do is capture the excitement of the time in order for it to be exciting all over again. And that again brings me back to where I started, really, which is that this story is a tremendously exciting story, filled with the most phenomenally interesting events and people. And it's rather been squashed flat by not being told very well for a very long time. And all I want to do is pump blood back into it, or oxygen back into it, and let it live again. And the material is there for me to do it, and my enthusiasm for it is such that I feel I can do it. So that's Volume 2. But don't hold your breath for it, because it's going to be a while yet, folks.
Dream Baby, which seems to be doing very well for Roy Orbison in the American charts, with Paul McCartney on vocal lead, it's the Beatles! Got to be sweet dreams the whole day through.
That was Dream Baby, sung by Paul, from a BBC performance on a show called Teenager's Turn, taped in March of 1962. So go back to that time. That's 2 months after the Decca audition. Pete Best is still on drums. It's before they even met George Martin, you know, well before Love Me Do. And here they are, you know, this great band cranking out the stuff for the BBC airwaves. And yet, this track does not appear on the forthcoming Live at the BBC Volume 2.
Yeah, don't get me going about that. I don't understand it. You know, they left some tracks off the first one. Okay.
Right.
And here we go again. I mean, I don't think they've included any of the 1962 tracks on the new one.
No, not
the
Pete Best stuff.
Yeah, and maybe they just don't want to pay Pete any more royalties. I don't know what this is about.
We cashed in with that.
It's so frustrating, you know. That.
Well, it's an interesting, you know, if you try to get into the heads of the people making these decisions, it's like, you can put together a listening experience for the casual fan that would probably be concentrating more on the familiar and the hits, or you could put out something that is sort of like this document of their radio work that's more all-inclusive. And I have to think that if you're a hardcore like us, you've already got the stuff. So maybe they're figuring, well, screw those people who've already got it. Let's just go for the casual people and make it just sort of greatest hitsy and not think in terms of scooping up the rare stuff and giving you like the umpteenth live take of She Loves You or something.
Right. But, I
can understand her thinking if I don't agree with it.
But that whole line of theirs, you know, they said in the past that some of that stuff is substandard audio.
Right.
Well,
substandard percussion.
Well, you know, but Keep Your Hands Off My Baby, which is on Volume 1,
right,
is from one of those 62 sessions.
And it sounds, it's fine.
It's absolutely fine.
I mean, it's great. Like, I mean, well, clearly they've got issues with the Star Club stuff, which I love to death, but yet they're sitting on it now that they finally got the rights back. Yeah. It's too bad, because that stuff, if you're any kind of fan, it is a priceless window into their development and really the only club document we've got of them.
Yeah.
You know, such as it is. You know, Ringo's on drums, it's at the tail end where they're, you know, not as interested in doing what they had been doing because they've got a recording contract now and, you know, one record release, another one about to drop. So, but there it is, and it's some fascinating performances on that.
Anyway, let's not prattle on about it too much, because we're going to actually talk about that much more in our next show.
Yes. Yeah. Dissect it, slice and dice it, criticize it.
Yes.
That's what we do. But now I think it's time, Richard, that we do a question from a listener.
Hello.
Yes, it's Melanie from Highland Park. And your question is?
My question is, who do you think in the end ended up being the closest to each other of the Beatles?
Well, after they split?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, good question. Well, as a general rule, wouldn't you say that Ringo had the best relations with the other three?
Yeah, I would say so. And I think at that time, it was most likely John and Ringo and George and Ringo who were most likely the closest. Because let's not forget that whole incident when, you know, they were going through all their hassles in 1969. And Ringo went and over to Paul's place, didn't he, and tried to make peace.
Yeah.
And Paul told him in no uncertain terms to put his coat on and get out. So
I'll finish you.
Yes.
All of you.
So I don't know how close they were initially, but I certainly know that, you know, John and Ringo were working on the first album together, the first solo album.
Yes.
And then also George and Ringo worked together, didn't they?
Yes. That year, 1970, Ringo worked with both of them on their debut Apple albums, All Things Must Pass and Plastic Ono Band. I think he would have worked with John on Imagine had he been free to do so, but he was working on Blind Man at the time. I know he popped around for the session because he was around when George was there and they were cutting How Do You Sleep? And he was the one that sort of advised John to tone it down.
Yes.
And he was getting carried away.
Yeah. But, and that stretched right through the mid-70s, didn't it? I mean, you even have, of course, the infamous Lost Weekend of John's that you referred to earlier.
Yes.
Yeah, where, you know, Ringo is one of the house guests at Santa Monica Beach House.
Right. And in fact, if you read her account of it, Nancy Andrews says it was John that really set the two of them up. That Nancy had been a friend of May's. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ringo was going through a hard time. He was separated from Maureen and kind of lost. And Nancy ended up, you know, coupling up with Ringo for a good number of years, largely at John and May's behest.
Yeah. By 73, of course, we do have, you know, everyone helping out on Ringo's album.
Yes. Whatever issues there were between Paul and Ringo smoothed it over by that time.
Right.
Yeah. So, and that, I think, you know, we could talk about the Ringo album on another show, but, you know, you look at the fantastic success of that album, you know, number one album from Ringo of all people, spawning, or no, take that back, it was number two album, because Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was dominating the charts at the time, but it had two number one singles, two number one singles from the same album. No ex-Beatle had done that to that point.
Right.
And Ringo of all people is the one that pulls it off. But I do think what was fueling that was, you know, you had this perception of a Beatle reunion of sorts on that record, with the three of them on John's I'm the Greatest, and then Paul on side two, with 6 o'clock, there's Paul and Linda, as well as
You're 16.
You're 16 too, him and Harry. You know, doing the sax impression that everybody calls a kazoo, which it isn't.
Oh, it isn't a kazoo. I didn't know that, actually.
No, I mean, that's a story that Paul never gets tired of telling. It's like, not a kazoo. It was me, you know, with his mouth imitating a sax, but it sounds like a kazoo.
There you go. I learned something today.
Well, you got to read my books.
Yeah. Oh, I do, Robert. I do.
Okay.
You come on like a dream, peaches and cream, lips like strawberry wine. You're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine.
Okay, so you listen to that this time with fresh ears. Does it still sound like a kazoo to you?
I suppose more like a comb and a handkerchief.
It could have been that. Could have been that. That's something you guys do in England, right? Like for fun?
Oh, absolutely. You know, whenever there's a party, get out the comb and handkerchief.
Right, because you guys didn't have cable then. All right, for the next show, we'll commemorate 50 years of With the Beatles, November 1963.
November 22nd, 1963, day of Kennedy's assassination.
Yes. Amazing. Two milestone events the same day.
Right. And then we're also going to be talking in much more detail about the second volume of Beatles Live at the BBC, so we can have another bitching session.
Yes. And you know, maybe play some things or play some things that aren't on that.
Right.
Because that's what we do. And just, you know, rake Apple over the coals one more time.
Absolutely. That's it. So that was Something About the Beatles.
From Richard
and Robert.
Bye.
Something About the Beatles. Produced by Thomas Rapetney at Strad Studio. Executive producer, Rick Wade.